Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who's Wise made for? It's made for jet setters and slow travelers, for online marketplaces and real-life bazaars, for business in the city and pleasure on the coast. Wise is made for studying abroad and supporting your little brother's schooling back home. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world. Missing Justice is an investigative true crime podcast from CBS News that examines the death of Christy Woodenthigh. On the night she was killed, Christy's family rushed to the scene in the Northern Cheyenne region and found no officers, no sirens, and no sign of Christy. This 6-episode series takes you inside what really happened that night and how the issues in Christy's case connect to the larger missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis. Listen to Missing Justice on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tragedy in the Mediterranean as a boat of refugees breaks apart. Some say European rules have made such disasters more likely. The incident this weekend in which some 100 migrants drowned off the coast of Italy is just the latest.
It's a particularly terrible example of a story that Europe's been seeing now for the last 7 or 8 years.
Also today, the story of the war in Ukraine sounds pretty different when Beijing is explaining it to its citizens.
China's officials are saying that the country pouring weapons into the war for the profit of its murderous arms dealers is America.
I'm Marco Werman, and some classic stories by British author Roald Dahl are getting an update.
It's just being kinder, isn't it? It's being better. And let's keep this in perspective. We're calling Augustus Gloop enormous rather than fat.
But some critics say the changes have gone too far. Those stories and more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for making it here. On Sunday, there was an attempt to stop a new cycle of violence in the Mideast before it gets any worse. Senior Israeli and Palestinian officials sat down together in Jordan, just as the situation on the ground in the Israeli-occupied West Bank seems to be spinning out of control. Sunday afternoon, Israeli settlers went on a rampage, burning and vandalizing hundreds of vehicles and buildings in several Palestinian villages. One Palestinian man was shot dead. This followed an attack in which a Palestinian gunman shot and killed 2 Israeli brothers. Since the start of the year, about 60 Palestinians have been killed, mostly in gun battles between Palestinian militants and Israeli troops. David Makovsky is a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It may be hard to identify a single event, David, but generally, are you able to say what's behind all the recent violence?
It's hard to put it all in one category. There's no doubt that there has been an escalation in the last 2 months, in particular since the new government began. The attacks in Jenin and Nablus are more focused, I believe, that the Palestinian Authority security apparatus has said, we're not going in there. If you want to go in, Israel, you know, you go in. Israel said, look, it doesn't want to go in, but there have been attacks on Israeli cities coming from these two areas. And once it went in, there were, you know, several Palestinians that were killed. The other thing, that dynamic that's happening, is it could be a run up to the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli and Palestinian security services are trying to stop violence of killers on the roads, shooting randomly at people. Because of people foreseeing this escalation, that the U.S. and Jordan and Egypt convened this meeting in Jordan yesterday with Israel and the Palestinian Authority to talk about intel cooperation between now and the end of March when Ramadan begins. The irony is that the Jordanian security officials and the Israeli security officials and the Egyptian security officials and the American security officials pretty much work together. So the good news is that they're all kind of in the same boat. They know each other by their first names. They work extremely closely. It's a part of the Middle East story that doesn't really get a lot of media attention. These intel guys are meeting all the time.
So you've actually tapped into kind of like a comparison of how bad things are right now when you look at the past. How bad are they right now?
It's bad because there's just not leadership on either side of the equation. And it enables the extremists on both sides to set the tone.
I mean, settlements have been proliferating for decades now. They're illegal. Explain what makes them illegal.
They're settlements that are near the urban borders of cities of Israel. And there was always in a sense that there would be a territorial exchange, which we called swaps. Israel would gain some of those border areas and in return would yield land elsewhere. So you don't shut the door for two states in the future. And other Israeli governments did that, didn't build outside the barrier in the areas that would be focused on for the Palestinian state. This government is doing that. And that's why there is this distinction between the block settlers near the border. But these are settlements more inland in a way that however you gerrymander a border, they are on the wrong side of it.
At this meeting in Jordan, King Abdullah of Jordan is there. Mm-hmm. He served as a peace broker in the past. What do you make of his role this time?
Look, I think he's trying to play a constructive role. I mean, you know, the old joke is if someone sneezes in the West Bank, they catch a cold in Jordan. These are adjacent areas. Some of them have the same families. Many of them are Palestinian families. And so I think they see Ramadan coming and it's like, oh, this is, you know, we just got to cool it. We just got to put a lid on this. We got to do whatever it takes. Are they going to be able to withstand the extremist attack on each other? And I think that is still yet to be determined.
David Makovsky is the director of the Koret Project on Arab-Israeli Relations at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. David, thank you very much.
Delighted to be with you.
Tens of millions of Nigerians voted for their next president on Saturday. It's not clear how long it will take officials to tally up the final results, but as the world's Halima Gikandi reports from Lagos, just casting a vote in this pivotal election was an important civic duty for many Nigerians.
On Victoria Island in Lagos, polling stations were set up under a normally busy overpass. Joy Ogbams was waiting in line, ready to cast her vote for president.
Everybody's coming out to vote. You know, for the previous years, some people just felt like, let me stay at home, my vote doesn't count. Just stuff like that. But this time around, everybody's coming out to vote.
She'd been waiting in line for about 2 hours and expected to wait two more. There's a new biometric voter ID system in place. It's supposed to make the process quicker and easier, but it had mixed results across the country. I asked Ogbams if the new technology made her trust the process more.
I don't know. This country, there's nothing. there's nothing money cannot do in this country, so I don't know. I can't trust them, but I'm just praying our vote counts. That's it.
Nearby, Elijah Achimi told me he traveled from the city of Jos, where he studies, so he could vote here near his family.
How far is that?
Jos is 2 days on the road.
So you traveled 2 days by road to get here?
Yes, 2 days.
Why?
Because I want to change in my country. I'm not happy with the way the situation is going, and I'm not seeing any progress. Right now, we need to get things right. If not, our children, ourselves, will suffer.
He said he's been telling his family and neighbors to vote too. Despite low voter turnout in recent elections, most Nigerians I speak with say the stakes are particularly high for this one, and they're willing to suffer through delays and disruptions to make their vote count.
Aha!
In another part of Lagos, a group of frustrated voters and polling agents flagged down our car, thinking we were election officials. They said they couldn't find their polling station.
Over 5 hours they've been looking for it. Over 5 hours, 6, 7 o'clock.
We tried to call the hotline number for the Electoral Commission, but none of the lines went through. Then a man in a car approached, saying he found the right place. We got back in our cars and followed him. Finally, we found the right polling place on the side of the road. Linda Okamaka was relieved.
You've been waiting how long to get to this point?
Oh, what's the time now? Let me check. This is 2:12. I've been here since 8 o'clock. I'm happy that I'm here now. And by the grace of God, I'm going to cast my vote. And I believe that my vote will count.
Okamaka said some people lost patience and left without voting, but she was determined because she missed out on voting in the last presidential election. Observers say Election Day was largely peaceful, but I visited one place in Lagos and met frustrated voters sitting on the ground, shaking their heads. They showed me a pile of torn ballots on the ground. Voter Anthony Ogwo told me how earlier in the day, armed men accosted them at a polling station.
So they now shot on the air, so we started running helter-skelter, and they were throwing stones at us. So I think one woman had a wound on her head.
He said the men took away the ballot box and threw their completed paper ballots into a nearby gutter. Ogwo said he helped retrieve them as evidence.
I still believe that, I still hope in God that this thing is going to steal. Those people that just voted after us, before they come to disrupt, their own will count. Yeah. So that's what I'm praying for. But me, I'm not happy that seeing my own, because one of my own should be here. So I'm not happy.
Other voters nodded, their disappointment visible on their faces. After the polls closed, I returned to Victoria Island. Dozens of voters were still lingering at their polling stations. People watched intently as electoral officials pulled votes from the ballot boxes one at a time to count them. Now comes the wait. After some delays, election officials are now uploading tallies onto a public portal from each of Nigeria's 36 states, plus the capital of Abuja. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Lagos.
There's some troubling news emerging about the relationship between the U.S. and the military government in Myanmar. Since Myanmar's army seized power in a coup 2 years ago, Washington has tried to isolate the junta through severe sanctions. It's even taken steps towards supporting an armed uprising to restore democracy in Myanmar. But details are emerging about closed-door meetings last week in which the U.S. helped to train the military of Myanmar, an army the White House has accused of horrific violence and even genocide. This training exercise flies in the face of the official U.S. policy, causing some to ask why Washington would assist a regime it is supposedly trying to weaken. The World's Patrick Wynn is following the story. What training did the U.S. provide to Myanmar's military, Patrick?
This was a training session co-hosted by the U.S. and Thailand, held here in Bangkok last week up through last Friday. And it wasn't just for Myanmar. It was group training for countries who are part of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. And it was a tabletop exercise. So that means military officers from the U.S., Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, and other countries, including Myanmar, are all sitting down at a table running through scenarios related to maritime security, with a focus on how to catch smugglers, groups smuggling drugs, people, or weapons through your country's coasts. And the U.S. was hosting this training, and as the big superpower in the room, it has the most professional Navy and the most to offer. And it was about 20 countries all together, all rubbing elbows with representatives from Myanmar's junta.
Why would the U.S. train a junta that it accuses of atrocities, even if Myanmar was just included in this wider ASEAN training?
Well, the Pentagon has responded by saying, look, we didn't invite Myanmar. Our co-host Thailand did. Thailand is a big U.S. ally. So to not train Myanmar's regime, the Pentagon would have had to say, look, if Myanmar is there, we're not coming. And they chose not to do that. Now, the U.S. has pulled out of very similar exercises with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations before. Last summer, Russia was invited to a very similar training session, and the U.S. said, no way, we're out, we're not coming. So the Pentagon will take a stand over certain countries, Russia, but apparently not Myanmar.
I mean, at the same time, this training with Myanmar involved does not conform with U.S. policy on Myanmar. Is this a sign the U.S. is changing its stance on Myanmar's junta, or just a really bad case of accidental invitation?
Yeah, the White House has come out and said, no, it is not a change in policy. So this is probably more of an isolated scandal. However, there's this fear among Myanmar's pro-democracy groups, who I've talked to recently. They're worried that Western countries like the U.S. will talk a big game, but, you know, kind of treat the junta in Myanmar as the legitimate government of the country, even though they seized power by force. And people do have a reason to worry. That is happening more and more. Tomorrow, here in Thailand, the UN is hosting its own training session about drug trafficking. And once again, a Myanmar junta official has been invited to that, too.
Just practically speaking, Patrick, what skills could Myanmar's military junta take away from this training? And could they ultimately delay the restoration of democracy there?
Well, the training was about securing coastal borders. And the coast is where refugees like the Rohingya get on boats to flee genocide. The coast is also one place where weapons might be smuggled into Myanmar to reach pro-democracy revolutionaries, you know, not just criminals, which the U.S. government is supposedly rooting for these pro-democracy forces. So the training is a bit self-defeating for the U.S. It's not a game changer for the junta, but I think, Marco, that it offers legitimacy to Myanmar's regime. Most Western countries do not accept the junta as the rightful government in Myanmar, do not even give them the time of day, usually. And what the junta really wants more than anything is to go to these international forums, which makes them feel like, hey, maybe everybody doesn't like us, but they do agree that we are the guys in charge.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For years in Finland, there's been a political debate about how to define indigenous identity. At times, there's been bitter disagreement. A recent effort to reform Finland's law on indigenous people actually failed to get across the finish line. From Inari, Finland, John Last has our report.
Here in Inari, in the far north of Finland, reindeer like these have been herded for hundreds of years by the Sami people, Europe's only recognized indigenous group. But in the small communities of Arctic Finland, Sami history has long been tied up with that of their Finnish neighbors, never more so than in the last 4 years, when Sami leadership has lobbied to change the law that defines who counts as an indigenous person and exclude hundreds of people who are claiming Sami identity.
If someone takes this identity, I am lost. I am totally lost.
Mirja Mattila speaks to me through a laptop screen from her home in rural Finland. Today, she's in her role as spokesperson for a group that calls itself the Association of the Original Sami of Finland. They defend a piece of Finnish law known as the Laplander Criteria. It allows anyone whose ancestor was a herder, hunter, or forester on these lands to claim a kind of indigenous status. It's this criteria that Sami leaders want to do away with, defining membership more narrowly on connections to Sami languages. On this, they have the support of the United Nations, the Finnish Prime Minister, and dozens of constitutional experts.
Those who are indigenous Sami, the forest Sami, they put aside.
But tucked away in a corner office at Finland's Arctic Institute, Juha Juna, a law professor, builds the case for the Laplander criteria. He says groups like Mattila's represent the real indigenous people of Finland, a southern group of so-called forest Sami who were displaced by northern herdsmen and suffered more rapid assimilation as a result, losing language and connections to their ancestors' culture. Outside a session of the Sami parliament, Anua Vaskari says there is some truth to this story. She's a Sami politician who's represented the community for many years. She says Inari is where Finnish colonization ran the deepest. Vaskari estimates there are more than 100 Sami in Inari who couldn't satisfy the language requirement for this reason. So it's a bit of a strange situation, she says, when some claim these people are Finnish wolves in sheep's clothing. What Avaskari is hinting at is the deep anxiety among many Sami here in Finland that groups like Mattila's are providing cover for Finns who want to obstruct progress towards Sami self-determination. Even Juna admits hundreds of thousands of Finns could claim Sami status on the basis of the Laplander criteria. On Friday, after a long fight, defenders of the Laplander criteria won out. The latest effort at reform failed, the result of political maneuvering by a pro-development politician with ties to movements like Mattila's.
Yeah, it's disappointing to see that Sami human rights are just a political game.
Tuomas Aslak Juuso is president of the Sami parliament. He says the decades-long debate over reforming the current law has subtracted from time Sami leadership should be spending on protecting their land and culture. Sami activist Petra Laiti has been fighting for over a decade to see the law changed.
This time we really did give it all we had, and that still wasn't enough.
She says fellow Sami youth are now losing interest in politics in the face of so many repeated defeats. It's not the end of the road yet. The bill may be reintroduced after a spring election in Finland, at which point activists like Laiti will have to renew the fight again. But she worries that Sami youth like her may not have another fight left in them.
When you've already given everything, what else do you have to give?
For The World, I'm John Last, in Inari, Finland.
This story was produced with the support of the Pulitzer Center. It's been almost 7 years since Britain decided to exit the European Union, the famous Brexit. Like many breakups, it's been a tricky and at times downright ugly divorce. Today, though, one of the stickiest parts of Brexit seems to have been solved by the UK and EU, the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. As with all things Brexit, it's not over just yet, though. Joining me now is our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry. The Brexit hangover lasts a long time, Orla. Before we talk about what was agreed today, explain briefly what this major stumbling block around Northern Ireland was all about and why it created such a headache.
Well, essentially, the Northern Ireland Protocol, as you said, it was a mechanism set up to prevent a hard border being established along the island of Ireland, a country that's all too familiar with the impact of a real militarised border with checkpoints between north and south. And the impact was that goods then travelling into Northern Ireland all had to undergo EU checks because Southern Ireland is part of the EU, and under the Brexit deal, Northern Ireland still remained part of the EU single market. So what we saw happening was, as a result, huge long delays at the ports in Northern Ireland because producers of so many goods like foodstuffs, etc., had to fill out a whole lot of paperwork that had to be then checked by customs, and that caused huge delays. It caused supermarket shelves to be emptied. Some British companies stopped supplying to Northern Ireland, saying that it was just too cumbersome to do so. And this naturally caused a lot of tension, particularly among unionist politicians in the north, who said they felt that Northern Ireland was being treated differently from the rest of the UK. As a result, the Democratic Unionists, they're the kind of hardline unionist party, they refused to take part in government in Northern Ireland since this protocol came into place. And then other politicians in Britain just saw it as a sign that the EU was still holding power over a part of Britain, and they hated it for that reason.
Republic of Ireland, of course, in the south, part of the EU, Northern Ireland, part of the UK, and following Brexit. So what was agreed to today?
Well, the major part of the agreement that was reached was about the movement of goods. So products heading into Northern Ireland and staying in Northern Ireland would no longer have to go through customs checks. There are other issues to do with a potential compromise on the European Court of Justice and its role and its powers in Northern Ireland. But I should say, Marco, when Rishi Sunak was talking about the deal today, he talked about it in terms of peace and why it was so important. And just a few days ago, you might have seen an off-duty policeman was shot several times in Oma, and he was coaching a local football team, and he was shot 4 times in the back, and it's widely believed to be a splinter IRA group who were behind the attack. Rishi Sunak opened his press conference with these words today.
All our thoughts are with Detective Chief Inspector John Caldwell and his family after last week's abhorrent shooting in Oma. A man of extraordinary courage, his first thought was to protect the children he had been coaching. President von der Leyen and I stand united with the people and leaders of all communities across Northern Ireland.
Orla, even though both sides appear to be fully in agreement this afternoon, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak still has to sell this deal back home. Will he be able to do that?
This is the ultimate question. The deal is said to run to around 100 pages, so no one outside the negotiating team has likely been able to read all of it yet. I mean, certainly they presented a united front, but the people that they'll have to convince to make it work are the politicians in Northern Ireland, and particularly the unionist politicians, and the Brexiteers in Rishi Sunak's own Conservative Party. And the Democratic Unionist Party leader said he does think that significant progress has been made today, but then he added the party wants to examine the text in detail. One kind of positive, I guess, for Rishi Sunak today is that it looks like the main opposition party, the Labour Party, is on board, but that, Marco, doesn't mean it solves the problem with the unionists in Northern Ireland, because if they don't like it, they will still refuse to get back into government, and that still leaves Northern Ireland in a stalemate without a fully functioning government.
The World's Orla Barry filling us in on the deal around the Northern Irish Protocol, just the latest twist and turn in the Brexit story. Orla, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
We'll be right back with the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. Since the war in Ukraine began, millions fled their homes. Across the world, people open their doors. Sometimes the welcome mat is only temporary.
It's hard on refugees. What do I do at the end of 1 month? You're not guaranteed that you can stay.
Building new lives far from home, still ahead, here on The World. I'm I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. China is preparing to host the leader of Belarus tomorrow. Alexander Lukashenko won his sixth term as president in 2020 in a vote that was widely seen as fraudulent. Lukashenko is a key ally of Vladimir Putin and backs Russia's invasion of Ukraine. His visit to Beijing comes just days after China announced what it's calling a peace plan for Ukraine. To find out what Lukashenko's visit to Beijing might mean, we reached out to David Rennie. He's the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist and joined us from the Chinese capital.
The Chinese, I'm sure, would say that this is nothing to do with the war in Ukraine, that Belarus is a longstanding partner of the Chinese, and that this doesn't say for a minute that China is anything other than a high-minded, peace-loving giant that is trying to bring peace to Europe with its plan for peace in Ukraine. The problem for China is that the number of Western leaders, at least, who believe that Chinese narrative about being neutral in this war and having a sincere goodwill peace plan is getting smaller and smaller. And I think the spectacle, simple spectacle on TV of seeing Xi Jinping, who has yet to speak to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky since the beginning of the Ukraine war more than a year ago, let alone meet him. The spectacle of seeing Xi Jinping rolling out the honor guard and the flags in Tiananmen Square and the Great Hall of the People for essentially Europe's last dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, a man who's propped up by the Russian leader Vladimir Putin after stealing an election and having to crush domestic protests in his own country. It could not be clearer that this is a giant autocracy, China, siding with a conveniently well-located small autocracy, Belarus, which is basically a puppet of Vladimir Putin. And so I think, you know, this already extremely threadbare Chinese claim to be a neutral party trying to bring peace at the one-year mark of the war in Ukraine is going to be, you know, further shredded by the sort of the show business and the diplomatic spectacle of this state visit.
We also have to see this in the context of what we've heard from U.S. officials saying they have intelligence suggesting that China is considering supplying military aid to Russia for its war in Ukraine. What are China's officials saying about that?
So China's officials are saying that this is not true and that the country pouring weapons into the war for the profit of its murderous arms dealers is America. And so every night on state television here, the Chinese public, who don't have access to anything other than state media and censored news, they are told that the war in Ukraine is the fault of America and NATO, and it's still going on because the wicked Americans are trying to pour in weapons because they're trying to hurt Russia because America doesn't like having any rivals. What I will say, though, is that if there's any truth to this, and if, as happened a year ago, American intelligence warnings turn out to have some basis in fact, then that would have an absolutely devastating effect on certainly European governments' views of China. I think it's been really interesting how China has lost trust already with some big European countries. Your listeners may remember that only a few months ago, there were some serious European leaders who talked about China as a likely mediator, that perhaps they could use their influence with Russia to end the war and stop Vladimir Putin. There is so little trust now that when China rolled out this incredibly threadbare 12-point peace plan last week, you saw some pretty senior European officials saying, we can't take China seriously as a mediator if the American warnings are ignored by China and they do deliver things like artillery shells, or there's, you know, some reporting in Germany about potentially Chinese companies talking about selling kamikaze drones, then that would be an absolutely massive deal. And I was actually at a big gathering of ambassadors here the other night, although it was all very off the record, so I can't tell you which country it was. Mm. I was talking to an ambassador who's not at all one of the most hawkish countries in this. And he said, if they are actually thinking about selling weapons to Russia, then you will see the entire of Europe absolutely as one turning on China and losing any trust in China as a kind of good faith neutral party in this.
There is this 12-point peace plan that Beijing recently put forward, its plan to wind down the war in Ukraine. How is it being portrayed in China's state-run media, and what does that tell us about the intent of this plan?
So point one is it's not a serious peace plan. It's basically a recycling of talking points that the Chinese have been pushing for the entire of this war about, essentially that it's blaming NATO, saying that because NATO expanded up to close to Russia's borders, it's NATO's fault that Russia felt it had no choice but to invade Ukraine, which is kind of talking point number one. And then, you know, they have all this high-minded language about, you know, standing absolutely for sovereignty of each country and its territorial integrity, which is rich frankly, if you're Ukrainian and you've just been invaded and your territorial integrity is being trampled, and the Ukrainian President Zelensky has yet to manage to get Xi Jinping on the phone. For the last year, the Chinese have basically just completely ignored him. And the fundamental message to the Chinese public about this peace plan is that it proves that China is, you know, the world's greatest power, that unlike the wicked Americans and other Europeans, China has never invaded any other country. It's a peace-loving giant. Now, it's obviously news to some of the countries that China has invaded in living memory, like Vietnam. But, you know, they have this whole kind of nationalist shtick that China is the only kind of benevolent great power out there, and that its peace plan is being hailed and welcomed around the world by grateful countries, and that the only countries that are not taking it seriously are the Americans and their kind of running dogs in Europe.
Well, a few weeks ago, before the spy balloon incident and subsequent back and forth of diplomatic rhetoric, the U.S. and China seem to be angling for some sort of stabilization of relations. Is there any getting back to that anytime soon?
Well, the logic that drove that kind of desire to lower tensions and to lower the temperature is still there. Tragically, I think what we saw with the spy balloon, which in the grand scheme of things is not the most serious superpower clash in history. There was no, you know, pilot shot down. There was no crew detained on the ground as we've seen with previous clashes. Mm. It was, you know, in some ways a very trivial incident. The fact that something so trivial could blow off course the Blinken visit to Beijing, I think tells you that the politics on both sides is so fired up that neither side felt able to back down. Both sides immediately started exchanging accusation and counter-accusation about the nature of this balloon. And so it's a really worrying sign, because the next time they have a clash, God forbid, it could be a lot more dangerous. I mean, if we saw a repeat of previous incidents where an actual spy plane with a crew on board hit a Chinese fighter, and, you know, you had an incident in 2001 where a Chinese pilot died after colliding with an American spy plane over the South China Sea. If that happened again now, 22 years later, it is very hard to see how that would be managed when these two superpowers struggled to manage something as trivial as a spy balloon.
David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. He joined us from the Chinese capital. Good to speak again, David. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Over the past year, some 8 million people fled their homes in Ukraine to other parts of the country. Another 8 million left and went to European countries. Close to 100,000 have been accepted by the U.S., many through the special Uniting for Ukraine visa program, which opens up a 2-year residency window for those who are approved. This is the story of one of them. On the 24th of February last year, Vera Ustianska and her family, daughter Vasi and husband Sergei, went down into the bomb shelter they had hurriedly built with their neighbors in their city of Zaporizhia. 5 days later, she noticed people began to leave the shelter. The next day, Vera decided she and 8-year-old Vasi needed to leave Ukraine altogether. She laughed when I asked her how hard that decision was. You think there was a discussion, she says? There was no discussion. My husband had to stay and fight. Vera told me that she took all the belongings she and her daughter needed, anything they could pack, in a little suitcase in the hallway. It took all of 30 minutes, and then they left. I met Vera and Vasi recently at their new home on this quiet street in San Diego, nearly 7,000 miles from her family and husband in Zaporizhia.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Connie.
Hi. Come on in.
Good to see you. How's
Good
everything?
Good to see you. Good.
They are now living in a Spanish colonial, the home of Connie Terwilliger.
I received an email from my association with Airbnb saying, would you like to donate a room to a refugee, back in February? And right after the war started. So I thought, well, sure, I have a nice big house and a couple of bedrooms and bathrooms that were not being used. So I said, yes.
But again, that was February 2022, when Vera fled her country, trying to find a safe place for her and her daughter. Vera is 34. She's an artist. Her paintings are in museums and private collections around the world. Vera told me that over the past 10 years, she didn't follow the news. She just wanted to create. I didn't believe this war would happen, she said. After months on the road and in temporary housing in Poland, they arrived at the home of a San Diego Facebook friend who liked Vera's paintings just as the school year was beginning for Vasi last September. It seemed like a place they could settle into for a while. But then, unexpected drama.
Але через місяць вони посварились.
It's hard to call her friend now, Vera told me, but after a month, the friend and her husband got into a big fight. The woman moved into a hotel. Her husband told Vera and Vasi they had to leave the house, even threatened to get them deported.
It's hard on refugees sometimes. What do I do at the end of 1 month, right? You're not guaranteed that you can stay.
Dima Korobsky is a staff volunteer with Nova Ukraine, which helps new arrivals settle in the U.S. What happened to Vera, he says, is not all that uncommon when it comes to Americans who want to sponsor refugees with material support.
Not all people who sponsor Ukrainian refugees can actually house, right? Some people sponsor multiple families and they don't have enough rooms in the house. And that's where our team comes in and try to find housing, where sponsor housing essentially falls through.
Among the challenges for many new arrivals is affording rent if housing does fall through. Vera is one of the lucky ones. Her host, Connie Terwilliger, the woman we met earlier, is putting her up rent-free for as long as she needs.
It turned out pretty well. Yeah, they got quite lucky with the host, who was fantastic.
They're my new family, actually. I never had any kids, and now I have kind of like a granddaughter, and it's wonderful. I'm absolutely enjoying the experience, and she's welcome to stay as long as she needs to.
Every day, Vera speaks with her husband, Sergei. He's repairing airplanes in Zaporizhia while Vera waits in San Diego for the war to end. Her daughter, Vasi, is learning English quickly and has made friends in school. In the garage-turned-art studio at Connie's house, Vera paints canvases of sunflowers, her favorite subject. She opened up to me in her newly acquired English to make sure I understood.
The last 6 months before the war, I painted very dark and depressive paintings with sunflowers.
Vera told me she worries that she had somehow foretold the war with those paintings. The day the war began marked the last time she picked up her brushes in Ukraine. The sunflowers she now paints in San Diego are bright yellow against blue skies. It's Vera's way to manifest victory for her country, her words, to keep it out of the darkness. Most everyone of a certain age knows this tune. Oompa Loompas, a few of the most memorable characters from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The Fantastic Tale is one of the big hits written by the late British author Roald Dahl. But as the world's Bianca Hillier tells us, that book, as well as other Roald Dahl classics, are now getting a controversial update.
If you read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory as a kid, or if you read it to your kids, you may remember Augustus Gloop being described as, quote, fat. Or Miss Trunchbull in Matilda as having a, quote, great horsey face.
Fresh meat.
Or maybe you remember the aunts in James and the Giant Peach as living in a, quote, queer ramshackle house. Not anymore. In the latest printing, Dahl's UK publisher Puffin and the Roald Dahl Story Company made hundreds of changes to the children's books. Language around weight, mental health, gender, and race has been cut or rewritten entirely.
When I looked into the scope of the changes, it really became apparent that they kind of went beyond the sort of surgical approach that I think you could justify.
Suzanne Nossel is the CEO of PEN America, a nonprofit defending freedom of expression around the world. She says it's not the edits themselves she takes issue with.
But it's more the notion that once you reopen these works and you accept the principle that they can be altered, you know, what's to stop a governor, for example, who's out there banning books from saying, oh, this book can be published in this state, but you've got to get rid of these passages or these depictions.
Nossel is one of many people across the globe speaking out against what some are calling absurd censorship of Dahl's books.
Er det rart de blir forbanna? Se svære TikTokere satt all fokus på Roald Dahl.
Por qué nos va a contar cómo este fin de semana? El escándalo fue de Roald Dahl.
Other people, though, don't see any issue with the changes.
British author Maz Evans told the BBC she doesn't see the edits as censorship.
It's just being kinder, isn't it? It's being better. And let's keep this in perspective. We're calling Augustus Gloop enormous rather than fat. We're not making him a plant-based vegan who's a TikTok influencer for Weight Watchers. You know, these are changes of words that we would not ask our children to use.
Evans also points out
there is precedent for Roald Dahl changing his work within his lifetime to make him more palatable.
For example, Oompa Loompas were originally described as black enslaved people from Africa who were paid in cocoa beans. 10 years later, Dahl removed the racist language and described Oompa Loompas as little fantasy creatures. The new rewrites affecting Dahl's books in the UK are varied. Many do include getting rid of the word fat, replacing mother and father with parents, and saying funny or strange instead of queer. But elsewhere, entire paragraphs are removed. Puffin did not reply to my requests for comment for this story, and the Roald Dahl Story Company declined to comment. But they told the AP they made these rewrites in conjunction with Inclusive Minds, a sort of DEI consultant for children's books. Inclusive Minds wrote me in an email that they don't actually rewrite the text. Instead, they give book creators feedback from people with relevant lived experience to help in the writing process. Nossel from PEN America says the exercise likely was well-intended.
You know, we're at a moment where we are revisiting societal norms and trying to think about how to present information in ways that make it truly open to a diverse population and a pluralistic society. And that's a worthy and important endeavor.
But she adds, scrubbing the past of what she calls unavoidable offenses is not the right path. Instead, Nossel suggests a warning message of sorts at the beginning of books, similar to how some Disney movies now warn viewers about racist depictions at the start of the film.
It may feel a little heavy-handed, but I think it's actually a better solution. It's kind of a conversation starter. Maybe you think, oh my gosh, why are they giving me this warning? But at least it makes you think, and the work of a creative artist is not being doctored.
Not all of Dahl's books will be altered. His publishers in the US, the Netherlands, France, and Spain have said they will not be adhering to the edits. And after listening to the feedback on the rewrites, UK publisher Puffin announced Friday they will also continue printing the original versions of Dahl's books, so readers can choose which one they prefer. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Over the weekend, a boat loaded with migrants and refugees broke apart off the southern coast of Italy. Around 100 people are now believed to have died, among them a dozen children. As of this morning, around 80 people were rescued from sea. Many are still unaccounted for. To learn more about this tragedy, we're joined by Andrew Geddes in Florence, Italy. He's director of the Migration Policy Center. Andrew, what do we know about the people who were on this boat?
Well, we know that it was a mix of men, women, and children. And we know that it comes from a variety of countries, particularly in Africa and the Middle East. Exact details about the people involved are still being gathered at the moment, but kind of conforms with a pattern of people from some of the poorest and least developed countries of the world or from conflict zones who are trying to get into Europe. So it's a particularly terrible example of a story that Europe's been seeing now for the last 7 or 8 years.
Right. I mean, I was going to say, it feels like seemingly endless stories like this one in the Mediterranean region. How often is this sort of thing still happening there?
It's happening constantly. So since around 2015, more than 20,000 people have been reported as dead or missing in the Mediterranean. So there's been a consistent and shocking loss of life on Europe's borders ever since the Syrian refugee crisis, which many people will be familiar with, which was at its height in 2015. Although before then, too, there were tragedies. There were still boats sinking and desperate people are taking desperate measures and often traveling in boats that really aren't equipped for the journey.
Yeah, in this case, migrants transiting on those rickety boats through Turkey. That seems a ways off from Italy. Is it common for these migrant boats to take this route to Italy?
There's a route from Turkey which more typically will go towards Greece. So a kind of very elongated route via Turkey towards Italy is not common. There have been claims made that increased in border controls forces people into more desperate routes, which may send them on more perilous and longer journeys. So the exact, again, information is only really coming to hand as we speak about the precise details of this event. But there is some concern that increased European efforts to stop the boats is actually forcing people into more lengthy and potentially deadly routes.
What has the Italian government said so far about this latest tragedy?
The immediate reaction of the Italian government was quite interesting, because the Prime Minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, who came to power only a few months ago, expressed her sorrow for the loss of life. What critics of the government have argued is that actually it's the policies of the government and its hard line on migrant boats that has contributed to this kind of tragedy by making it more difficult and dangerous for people to cross.
As to this more restrictive policy that Giorgia Meloni's government has passed a law around, what does that law do exactly?
What it's trying to do is stop boats with migrants disembarking at Italian ports, or make it far more difficult for them to do so, particularly the NGOs, the non-governmental organisations who are effectively operating rescue boats in the Mediterranean, trying to pick up migrants in distress and bringing them to points of safety.
At a moment like this, Andrew, when Prime Minister Meloni is saying we have a law to keep these people from leaving in the first place, and, well, now here's a situation where they did leave and children have died, how does she navigate this particular tragedy?
Well, that's a very good point, because Italy can't legislate to stop people leaving other countries. It could try to cooperate with those countries to stop them leaving, but that means, for instance, trying to work with the authorities in Libya, which is quite tricky because Libya is in domestic political turmoil. So you end up trying to reach agreement with non-EU countries to control movement of people from those countries towards the European Union. And that's proving difficult. And as we saw only last week, the president of Tunisia launched a very strong attack on migrants in Tunisia, which was then condemned for its targeting of African migrants by the head of the African Union.
Andrew, this wreckage at sea, 100 people, maybe more dead, as you said, it's a kind of tragedy we've seen time and again over the past decade or so. Ultimately, what has to change to prevent it?
Well, that's the most difficult question, because the issue that European governments are very reluctant to address is the provision of what are sometimes called kind of safe and legal pathways. So the argument that's made is that if you want to reduce some of this pressure for irregular migration, then actually pathways need to be open that allow people to travel safely towards Europe. Now, this is very controversial in European politics, the idea that you do allow some facilitated migration. So this is really the crux of it. Tough border controls will likely lead to these kind of tragedies, but an approach which allows some facilitated migration is likely to be politically controversial, and it's not the kind of approach that prime ministers like Giorgia Meloni were elected on.
Andrew Geddes is director of the Migration Policy Center. He joined us from Florence, Italy. Thank you very much for your time, Andrew.
Thank you.
Underpinning so much of what you do these days is this sound. That is the incessant hum of a server farm, tens of thousands of computers all stacked row upon row in massive warehouses. The server farm noise comes from electric fans dissipating the heat produced by the electronic components. Cloud computing companies like Amazon have built data centers like this around the globe, handling everything from your request to the fastest route home, to document storage, to serving up podcasts. You could call the servers the beating heart of the internet, all sharing one big problem: what to do with all the heat they generate.
If you've ever had a laptop on your lap, you know what that heat is.
John O'Shea leads the heat and electricity division at Codema, the energy agency for the city of Dublin, that has a plan for using all that heat from the Amazon servers.
What we have is essentially a coil in that air handling unit that absorbs the heat from the air. So that goes into water in this coil, and then that's pumped to our energy center.
Warm water from the server farm is piped into a nearby energy center run by the city.
When the warm water hits the heat pumps then, so the heat pumps essentially work like your refrigerator in reverse,
turning out very hot water that's piped into nearby buildings.
The first buildings to connect are essentially a kind of a university campus.
The 5,000 students of Technological University Dublin returned from holiday break last month to buildings heated entirely by waste heat from Amazon.
You just walk into the buildings and you feel the same heat that you always felt, but you just know that it's low carbon and you're using essentially a heat source that was, you know, otherwise going to be dumped into the atmosphere.
O'Shea has more plans for Dublin, like using heat wasted by supermarket refrigeration units and by the city's solid waste incinerator.
That heat is currently being dumped into Dublin Bay, currently heating the fish. So we want to basically attach it to a district heating network so it can heat the people instead.
O'Shea says the system took just a few months to get up and running. The benefits came right away. Amazon saves money by using less air conditioning to cool its servers. Dublin saves on its heating bills.
But also in general, just trying to save the world from climate change.
John O'Shea, who leads the heat and electricity division at Dublin's energy agency, Codema, ending our show today on a warm note. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.
668. That's how many people donated to the World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 668 helped us surpass our goal of $67,000. And we want to thank some of those incredible donors right now. Ali Ali, David Polston, Michelle Gates, Jennifer Hayes, Janetta Stringfellow, Brian Adams, Sarah Schaefer, Tanya Hyatt-Evenson, Michael Taylor, Simon Holwell. And thank you to not only the 668 donors, but to all of our listeners. We couldn't have done it without you.